Well, as those of you who have been keeping up with the news probably are well aware, the Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy increasingly lately has pointed out that the number one domestic problem facing America is the race problem. And I think he even emphasized this on the news this morning, that the number one problem facing America is the race problem. And the interfaith conference that was held in Chicago by Protestants, Catholics, and Jews last week also emphasized that the number one problem is the race problem, a problem that should be solved, and the solution to it, or the solving of it, is already long overdue. Another emphasis was placed upon this by the governor of North Carolina, a state in which the rights of the black man have always been trampled on. But yet the governor of that state this week also made a speech that emphasized the importance of solving this problem. Now, one of the reasons that the problem remains, as a Muslim who follows the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, we see where one of the main reasons the problem has never been solved and can never be solved, our people, the black people, of which there are 20 million in this country, always leave the solving of the problem to the white man. And since it is the white man who's guilty and whose deeds created the problem, his own guilt makes it almost impossible for him to approach the problem objectively and see the factors that are involved objectively and bring about a sensible solution. So the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us, and I might point out that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is the religious leader of the black people in this country who have left the Christian church, left the Christian religion, and have become Muslims by accepting the religion of Islam. And he points out to us, or teaches us, that the only way the problem of the black man in America can be solved is we have to solve it ourselves. We have to forget our own differences, forget the fact that we're Baptist, Methodist, Muslim, Democrat, Republic, and other divisions, and forget our differences and come together and pool our own resources, utilize our own education, our financial resources, educational ability, and do something to solve this problem ourselves instead of waiting for the white man to solve it. And I might point out too that it is our reluctance to wait for the white man to solve the problem, or our feeling or conclusion that we've reached that the white man can't solve it, and without compromise we take this approach. The picture is put out and projected that we are a hate group, we hate whites, and there's no type of dealing that can be done with whites, and this makes the problem only that much worse. So I'm here at the university, at Michigan State University, to make myself available to anyone who's genuinely interested in seeing how we look at the problem and the solution that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad has offered or has to offer.
Sir, you made a mention at the beginning of your introduction to Attorney General Robert Kennedy. He said, referring to the recent Post article, that your organization is not a subversive organization, does not wish to overthrow the government. Do you maintain that the Attorney General is not doing enough?
The Attorney General can't say anything else but that. After 32 years of investigating what Mr. Elijah Muhammad teaches, the FBI can say nothing other than that he is a religious man with religious motivation, religious objectives, and is using the religion of Islam to show us how to solve the problems for ourselves. And for the Attorney General to say anything else but that would be other than the truth. On the other hand, when you ask me, is he doing something to solve the problem? Taking 15,000 troops and sticking one little Negro in Oxford, Mississippi, is no solution to the problem. Spending $600 or $700 million to force one Negro into some college down in Oxford, Mississippi, is no solution to the problem. To solve the problem, you have to get to the root, and you have to face the facts. Or you have to face up to all of the factors involved in the problem. And this hasn't been done by the Attorney General. It hasn't been done by the President. It hasn't been done by the Congress, the Senate, the Supreme Court, or anyone else. But it is being done by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And the approach he uses stems from the fact that he has sat down and analyzed the factors that produced the problem in the first place and faces up to them.
And what is Mr. Muhammad's way of doing it?
And if you notice, instead of working on the white man, he works on the black man. Instead of spending his time trying to get black people to force themselves upon whites, he teaches black people that which eliminates the inferiority complex created by 400 years of enslavement and 100 years since the so-called Emancipation Proclamation of brainwashing in what they call an educational system that today has the black man looking down upon himself, hating what he is, hating his own kind, despising his own past, his own culture, and therefore it's almost impossible for the American so-called Negro even to have the incentive to solve this problem himself. So everything Mr. Muhammad teaches is designed to restore to the black man confidence in himself by teaching him a knowledge of that which he was before he was kidnapped by the white man and brought down to the level that he's on today. Yes, sir.
I believe you said before, sir, that you're working for an entirely separate way of living between the blacks and the whites, separated completely. By doing this, aren't you actually abandoning everything the Negroes ever worked for, racial equality?
I don't think black people want racial equality. Black people want equality. Equality has nothing to do with race. A man is equal whether there's another man around or not. And you, the black people in America who think in the present day way of thinking don't attach their equality or don't connect their equality with the white man. I don't want to be equal to a white man. I want equality. And my desire for equality has nothing whatsoever to do with the white man. I want equality whether there's a white man on earth or isn't a white man on earth. And this is a mistake that the white people make by putting themselves up as the criteria and telling the black man, you're equal to me, or you are as good as I, and the white man himself is not the yardstick that you use today to measure equality, justice, or freedom, or anything else.
Referring again to the latest edition of the Post article, it said that some members of your sect display open hatred to such prominent people as UN Under Secretary Ralph Bunche, Reverend Martin Luther King, and some have even called the U.S. Court of Appeals Judge Thurgood Marshall the ugly American. What justifications are there for this, if it is true?
Well, I know of no Muslim who has referred to Thurgood Marshall as the ugly American. And as so far as Ralph Bunche is concerned, Ralph Bunche has attacked the Muslims, has attacked Mr. Muhammad. He also has attacked me. And who's this other person you mentioned?
Martin Luther King.
Well, anybody who teaches black people to turn the other cheek, who robs the black man of his right to defend himself, is not a leader or a spokesman for black people. And it's wrong to teach the black man to turn his cheek until someone gets around here and teaches white people to turn their cheek. If the black man must suffer peacefully in the face of brutality, then the white man should learn how to suffer peacefully in the face of brutality, which we don't see any evidence that he has learned to do this.
In other words, you say your ultimate goal is complete separation from the whites. A world of your own, so to speak?
The Honorable Elijah Muhammad says that the only way the black man will ever rise is to raise himself up, lift himself up in his own world, in his own society. The only time you have equality of opportunity is when you're in a position to create your own opportunity. But as long as you have to stand in line and beg another man for a job, you might have equality of opportunity to beg for a job, but that's not what will solve our problem. We need some factories like whites have factories. We need our own agricultural system where we can feed and clothe our own people, and this is equality when we can create our own equality. And this is what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is training and teaching the black people in this country that we must do if we want a solution to the problem.
Thank you.
I'd like to go back over your explanation of what Muslim says and the reason. Mm-hmm. I think this was very good, and this is what we'd like to point out. You say you've always been getting adverse type publicity, and this isn't what I'm after. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Grand Rapids, we didn't do too badly there, mm-hmm. I don't believe. So I think if we can get this explanation.
But you'll ask the questions.
No, I'd rather you just go ahead and
it's hard for me to.
because it's pretty, I can't offer the camera. I'll probably be running out of film. I'll let you know when I run out of film, and I'll reload it and we'll shoot some more. I'd like to get a couple of hundred feet because we're going to be doing a special program.
I can't even hardly talk that long. If you're going to ask me a question,
I'll give you questions.
Okay,
I'll give you questions.
Good.
But let's start with these two here right now, okay?
And when you get over there, you ask it.
No, when I get over there, I'll just turn on the camera and point at you. How's that?
And ask me the, well, ask me the question and then turn on the camera.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then the question being, what is the Muslims and why?
Well, the Muslims here in America are black people who have turned away from the Christian religion and who are today following the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and practicing the religion of Islam. And we are Muslims because the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that this is the only way we'll solve our problem, through a religious solution rather than through a political solution, which means relying on God to help us in the solution instead of relying on these political hypocrites who do nothing but create the problem and then perpetuate the problem by false promises to the so-called Negro when they ask for some kind of relief from the conditions that they suffer. Second most anything. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad, number one, is the religious head, the religious leader of all the Muslims here who have turned from Christianity to Islam. And all of us are number two right behind him. All of us are number two. The press, as I said earlier, likes to sensationalize so they can sell papers. So they always have to make someone number this, number that, and number something else. But I have seen enough of what happens to people in number two spots not to have any desire to sit in that hot seat.
There was also, in the same particular article in Look, they mentioned Meredith, his activity that he was sort of frowned upon, the fact that he was trying to integrate.
I don't think that anybody frowns upon Meredith because Meredith is just being used by higher interests for their purposes, more so than in anything that's of any benefit to Meredith. Meredith hasn't benefited at Oxford, Mississippi. You don't benefit a sheep that's put in the midst of wolves that doesn't get any benefit out of being placed in such a predicament. The America only used that and blew it up all over the world to try and paint the picture abroad that she's doing something to solve the problem. But now she's embarrassed because the problem is still unsolved. She's out maybe $6 or $10 million, and a lot of soldiers have been tied up down there when they probably could have been using those same soldiers down in Cuba or South Vietnam or someplace where she's in worse trouble. So Meredith is just a little instrument, as is almost all Negroes who are involved in incidents of that sort, from the Freedom Rides to the sit-ins and every other move that has brought about nothing but token integration. Because a black man is not going to be satisfied with crumbs or tokens. So whenever you see a black man involved in any kind of action from which he'll only get crumbs or tokens, that's not his program. He might think it is, If a dog goes out and bites a man, he thinks he wants to bite the man. His boss sicks him on the man. And that's what happens to the Negro in this country when he's involved in almost any kind of action that he participates in. If you study that thing from afar or objectively, usually you'll find there's a hand hidden that moves it rather than him moving it himself. Yes, sir?
What is your view of the voter registration drives being conducted throughout the South, particularly in Southwest Georgia and Mississippi Delta?
My opinion of the voter registration drive, I can answer more easily if you tell me who is financing the voter registration drive.
In Southwest Georgia, it's SNCC and the Southern Contragenic.
Where did they get the money? No, they were subsidized, and they got the money from a society called the Taconic Foundation in New York. Now, you tell me who belongs to the Taconic Foundation and what are their motives for wanting this voter registration drive. Plus, it was also financed somewhat by Robert and John Kennedy. I might refer you to the article by Lewis Lomax that was written in Harper's. I think it came out in either the May or June issue of 1962, dealing with Kennedy's connections, where his hand is involved in the voter registration drive in the South. Pretty good article. So it's not what do I think of the drive itself, but what do I think of the motive behind the drivers. Yes, sir?
Sir, could you tell me, in your opinion, what do you think is the general consensus of people in the undeveloped areas of the world or in communistic countries in regards to the Maryland situation, seeing that our country has sent members of the Peace Corps over with certain objectives when something like this happens in our own?
They're not fooled by that. The only reason Peace Corps and these other outfits are sent abroad is try and win those people. They're not sent out of sentiment or ethics or morality. They're sent primarily to achieve a certain objective. It's the 20th century missionary, and they do the same work in this century that the missionary did in the last century. But they don't fool the people abroad. And when you speak of underdeveloped areas, I imagine you mean also Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama. Those are the underdeveloped areas. Because those people over there have a higher sense of morals and morality, and I have a higher regard for freedom and human dignity than you find existing right here in America, that's supposed to be the bastion or citadel of democracy and freedom, justice and equality and all that other kind of stuff. Yes, sir?
Sir, what are your organization's ultimate goals, not so much in the general area of equality, but more specifically in economics, social relations, and geographic area, anything else?
Human dignity covers it. The only way a man can be respected and regarded as a human being is if he can stand on his feet like a man, and in order to stand on his feet like a man, he has to have everything that is a man's right by birth. You can't make me a man. As long as these black people have to sit around here and wait for the government to legalize and make them men, they'll still be boys. You become a man by doing a man's job and by doing for yourself what men do for themselves. And the Negro has approached this whole thing as a boy, waiting for his master or the great white father to drop crumbs from the table. And the sooner whites realize that there are black people in this country who have grown up, and that they're not represented by King or any of the others who talk this turn the other cheek, beg for this and that philosophy, then the white man will take whatever steps or measures necessary to bring about a solution to this problem before it blows him off the planet, before it, I should say, causes him to cease.
Do you think you will, in fact, be have equality in the human sense of it, living in an isolated...
When Patrick Henry wasn't talking isolation, for George Washington, you didn't say he talked isolation when he wanted to separate himself from England. Anytime black people want some kind of freedom and complete independence, the first thing the white man asks is, you sure you can make it? Why, the founding fathers weren't worried about whether or not they could make it, and there wasn't any factories over here then, there wasn't any educational system over here then. This was a wild wilderness, and still they struck out for themselves because they were men, they were pioneers. Well, black people today are of the same framework, mental framework. We can solve our own problems. All we need is the same thing that Patrick Henry and Washington and John Adams and the rest of them got, a continent. And they weren't sitting around waiting for someone to give it to them. They took it from the Indians and then took our people over here and made us work it and build it up. Well, we'll do the same thing. Yeah.
One question, John. One, were you interviewed by the Saturday Evening Post writers before they wrote the article? Two, how many chapters does your group have, and are any of them in countries other than the United States?
As I told you earlier, every place you find Negroes today, you find Muslims who follow Mr. Muhammad. And was I interviewed? Whenever a national circulation is going to write any kind of story about Muslims, usually they'll come and ask you two or three questions, but they've already got the article written before they come to you. They come to you just enough to be able to say or lend authenticity to what they're going to write. But most of these articles that appear in national circulations usually are propaganda articles. They're designed to project a certain image, usually designed, they think, to hurt us. But the worse they talk about us, the more we grow. All you got to do today to wake a Negro up is talk about another black man or talk against him. And that says, lets the Negro know that man must be all right. Yes.
Yeah, we'll say it again. Sir, I am drawing back from memory now of an interview that we had in Grand Rapids approximately 3 years ago. And at that time, as I recall, your plan of equality had a timetable. And drawing again from memory, it seemed like it was 1965. Am I correct?
No, I've never heard the Honorable Elijah Muhammad mention a timetable, only in the sense he says time is up, that the white man is living at the end of his time is getting short, his time is running out.
I see.
But
I've
never heard him specify any specific dates.
I was wondering if this was the case, and my memory had served me right, how this timetable was coming.
The timetable is good because black people are waking up. The awakening of the black man is one of the main ingredients involved in the white man's whole existence on this earth today. And as long as the black man sleeps, the white man continues to live on borrowed time. But when the black man wakes up, that's it.
Now, one more question. What is your opinion of the difference, if there is any difference, between the Negro of the North and the Negro of the South?
The Negro in the North has been fooled by the white man in the North. The Negro in the South is afraid of the white man in the South. The Negro in the South is facing a wolf. And so that Negro in the South, naturally, he has fear, and it's no dishonor to be afraid of a wolf. But the Negro in the North is dealing with a fox, a white man who poses as a liberal and pretends that he wants to help the Negro solve his problem. He's being foxy. So it creates a situation where the Negro in the South will do more to correct his own problem than the Negro in the North. You get the beggars from the Negroes in the North. They try and say that this integrated education will solve the problem. The Negro in the South has never had integrated education, yet if you find Negroes right here in Lansing who are in business and who own something, they're Negroes from the South. Whereas the Lansing Negro, who has had an overdose of integrated education, he's the one that's standing in line begging you for a job or demanding a chance to live in your neighborhood. He doesn't have enough incentive to go out and do something for himself. So actually, the Negro from the South and in the South is better off than the Negro in the North or the Negro who's from the North.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
This is a press conference, and we hope that you all will be able to keep four promptly. If we want to get underway, we have to be out by a specified time. So as soon as you clear this out, as soon as we'll be able to get things going. Thank you for coming out.
Mr. Moderator, and to the African Students Association and the NAACP chapter here on the campus, and the students and faculty and friends, I would like to start out by thanking those who are responsible for our being here, for the invitation to speak here on the campus at Michigan State University, and to express our views on what we feel is America's most serious problem, the race problem. And it should be pointed out at the outstart that I represent the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, whose followers are known as the Muslims
here in America, and actually are the fastest growing religious group among black people anywhere in the Western Hemisphere. And it is our intention to try and spell out what the philosophy and aims and motivations of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad happen to be, and his solution to this very serious problem that America finds herself confronted with. And I might point out, too, that if you don't think that the problem is serious, then you need only to listen to the Attorney General, Robert F. Kennedy. In almost every speech he's been involved in, especially during the past few months, and even today, he has pointed out that the race problem is America's most serious domestic problem. And since the problem is so serious, it's time to take some serious steps to get to the factors that create this problem. And again, I want to thank the African Students Association and the campus NAACP for displaying the unity necessary to bring a very controversial issue before the students here on campus. The unity of Africans abroad and the unity of Africans here in this country can bring about practically any kind of achievement or accomplishment that black people want today. And when I say the Africans abroad and the Africans here in this country, the man that you call a Negro is nothing but an African himself. But some of them have been brainwashed into thinking that Africa is a place with no culture, no history, no contribution to civilization or science. So many of these Negroes, they take offense when they're identified with their homeland. But today we want to point out the different types of Negroes that you have to deal with. And once you know there's more than one type, then you won't come up with just one type solution. And to point out how timely the invitation is or was, I don't want to read newspapers to you, but in the Detroit News, dated Thursday, January the 17th, it told about the Interfaith Council of Religion that was held in Chicago last week. And the topic of their conversation was the race problem here in America. And it pointed out that all of the time that they spent and money that they spent, actually they didn't get to the meat of the issue. And in this particular copy of the paper, on page 3, the chaplain at Wayne State University actually criticized the efforts of these Protestant Catholics and Jews in Chicago last week for failing to bring spokesmen to that conference who really would speak for black people and spell out issues that were not being spelled out by the others. And I just want to read a recommendation that he made. Mr. Boyd believes that the conference might have accomplished much good if the speakers had included a white supremacist and a Negro race leader, preferably a top man in the American black Muslim movement. He said that a debate between them would undoubtedly be bitter, but it would accomplish one thing. It would get some of the real issues out into the open. And I think that the man is right. Most of the so-called Negroes that you listen to on the race problem usually don't represent any following of black people. Usually they are Negroes who have been put in that position by the white man himself. And when they speak, they're not speaking for black people. They're saying exactly what they know the white man who put them in that position wants to hear them say. So again, I think that it was very progressive and objective on the part of these two sponsoring groups to give us an opportunity to tell you how black people really think and how black people really feel and how dissatisfied black people have become, increasingly so, with the conditions that our people find ourselves in here in this country. Now, in speaking in professing to speak for black people, by representing the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, you want to know, who does he represent? Who does he speak for? There are two types of Negroes in this country. There's the bourgeois type, who blinds himself to the conditions of his people and who is satisfied with token solutions. He's in the minority. He's a handful. He's usually the hand-picked Negro who benefits from token integration. But the masses of black people who really suffer the brunt of brutality and the conditions that exist in this country are represented by the leadership of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So when I come in here to speak to you, I'm not coming in here speaking as a Baptist or a Methodist or a Democrat or a Republican or a Christian or a Jew or not even as an American. Because if I could stand up here and speak to you as an American, we wouldn't have anything to talk about. The problem would be solved. So we don't even profess to speak as an American. We are speaking as I'm speaking as a black man. And I'm letting you know how a black man thinks, how a black man feels, and how dissatisfied black man should have been 400 years ago. So, and if I raise my voice, you forgive me or excuse me. I'm not doing it out of disrespect. I'm speaking from my heart, and I'll let you, and you get it exactly as the feeling brings it out. When I pointed out that there are two kinds of Negroes, some Negroes don't want a black man to speak for them. That type of Negro doesn't even want to be black. He's ashamed of being black. And you'll never hear him refer to himself as black. Now, that type we don't pretend to speak for. You can speak for him. In fact, you can have him. But the ones that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad speaks for are those whose pattern of thinking, pattern of thought, pattern of behavior, pattern of action is being changed by what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is teaching throughout America. These are that mass element, and usually when you hear the press refer to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, they refer to him as a teacher of hate or an advocator of violence or what's this other thing, black supremacists. Actually, this is the type of propaganda put together by the press thinking that this will alienate masses of black people from what he's saying, but actually the only one whom that type of propaganda alienates is this Negro who's always up in your face begging you for what you have or begging you for a chance to live in your neighborhood or work on your job or marry one of your women. Well, that type of Negro naturally doesn't want to hear what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is talking about. But the type that wants to hear what he's saying is the type who feels that he'll get farther by standing on his own feet and doing something for himself toward solving his own problem instead of accusing you of creating the problem and then at the same time depending upon you to do something to solve the problem. So you have two types of Negro, the old type and the new type. Most of you know the old type. When you read about him in history during slavery, he was called Uncle Tom. He was the house Negro. And during slavery, you had two Negroes. You had the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro usually lived close to his master. He dressed like his master. He wore his master's secondhand clothes. He ate food that his master left on the table. And he lived in his master's house, probably in the basement or the attic, but he still lived in the master's house. So whenever that house Negro identified himself, he always identified himself in the same sense that his master identified himself. When his master says, "We have good food," the house Negro would say, "Yes, we have plenty of good food. We have plenty of good food." When the master said that we have a fine home here, the house Negro would say, "Yes, we have a fine home here." When the master would be sick, the house Negro identified himself so much with his master, he'd say, "What's the matter, boss? We sick?" His master's pain was his pain. And it hurt him more for his master to be sick than for him to be sick himself. Well, if the house started burning down, that type of Negro would fight harder to put the master's house out than the master himself would. But then you had another Negro out in the field. The house Negro was in the minority. The masses, the field Negro, were the masses. They were in the majority. When the master got sick, they prayed that he died. If his house caught on the fire, they prayed for a wind to come along and fan the breeze. If someone came to the house Negro and said, "Let's go, let's separate," naturally that Uncle Tom would say, "Go where? What could I do without boss? Where would I live? How would I dress? Who would look out for me?" That's the house Negro. But if you went to the field Negro and said, "Let's go, let's separate," he wouldn't even ask you where or how. He'd say, "Yes, let's go." And that would end it right there. So now you have a 20th century type of house Negro today. A 20th century Uncle Tom. He's just as much an Uncle Tom today as Uncle Tom was 100 and 200 years ago. Only he's a modern Uncle Tom. That Uncle Tom wore a handkerchief around his head. This Uncle Tom wears a top hat. He's sharp. He dresses just like you do. He speaks the same phraseology, the same language. He tries to speak it better than you do. He speaks with the same accent, same diction. And when you say your army, he says our army. He haven't got anybody to defend himself, to defend him. But anytime you say we, he says we. Our president, our government, our Senate, our congressman, our this and our that. And he hasn't even got a seat in that hour, even at the end of the line. So this is the 20th century Negro. Whenever you say, use the personal pronoun in the singular or in the plural, he uses it right along with you. When you say you're in trouble, he says, yes, we're in trouble. But then there's another kind of black man on the scene. If you say you're in trouble, he says, yes, you're in trouble. He doesn't identify himself with your plight whatsoever. And this is the thing that the white people in America have got to come to realize, that there are two types of black people in this country. One who identifies with you so much so he will let you brutalize him and still beg you for a chance to sit next to you. And then there's one who's not interested in sitting next to you. He's not interested in being around you. He's not interested in what you have. He wants something of his own. He wants to sit someplace where he can call his own. He doesn't want a seat in your restaurant where you can give him some old bad coffee or bad food. He wants his own restaurant. And he wants some land that he can build that restaurant on, and a city that can go in. He wants something of his own. And when you realize that this type of thinking is existing and developing swiftly behind the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad among the so-called Negroes, then I think you'll also realize that this old phony effort at integration is no solution, because the most you can do with this phony effort toward integration is to put out some token integration. And whereas this Uncle Tom will accept your token effort, the masses of black people in this country are no more interested in token integration than they would be if you offered them a chance to sit inside a furnace somewhere. The only one who'll do that is this 20th century Uncle Tom. And you can always tell him, because he wants to be next to you. He wants to eat with you. He wants to sleep with you. He wants to marry your woman, marry your mother, marry your sister, marry your daughter, and if you watch him close enough, he's even after your wife. This type has blind faith in your religion. He's not interested in any religion of his own. He believes in a white Jesus, white Mary, white angels, and he's trying to get to a white heaven. When you listen to him in his church singing, he sings a song, I think they call it, Wash Me White as Snow. He wants to be turned white so he can go to heaven with a white man. It's not his fault. It's actually not his fault. But this is the state of his mind. This is the result of 400 years of brainwashing here in America. You have taken a man who is black on the outside and made him white on the inside. His brain is white as snow. His heart is white as snow. And therefore, whenever you say this is ours, he thinks he's white the same as you. So what's yours, he thinks it's also his, even right on down to your woman. Now, many of them will take offense at my implying that he wants your woman. They'll say, no, this is what Bilbo and Talmadge and all of the white citizens' councils say. They say that to fool you. If this is not what they want, watch them. And if you find evidence to the contrary, then I'll take back my word. But all you have to do is give him a chance to get near you, and you'll find that he is not satisfied until he's sitting next to your woman or closer to her than that. So what the Honorable, in this type of Negro, usually he hates black and loves white. He doesn't want to be black. He wants to be white. And he'll get on his bended knees and beg you for integration, which means he would rather than live with his own kind who love him, he'll force himself to live in neighborhoods around white people whom he knows don't mean him any good. And again, I say, this is not his fault. He is sick. And as long as America listens to this sick Negro who is begging to be integrated into the American society, despite the fact that the attitude and actions of whites are sufficient proof that he is not wanted, why then you are actually allowing him to force you into a position where you look just as sick as he looks. If someone holds a gun on a white man and makes him embrace me, put his arm around me, this isn't love, nor is it brotherhood. What they're doing is forcing the white man to be a hypocrite, to practice hypocrisy. But if that white man will put his arm around me willingly, voluntarily, of his own volition, then that's love, that's brotherhood, that's a solution to the problem. Likewise, as long as the government has to get out here and legislate to force Negroes into a white neighborhood, or force Negroes into a white school, or force Negroes into white industry, and make white people pretend that they go for this, all the government is doing is making white people be hypocrites. And rather than be classified as a bigot by putting a block, the average white person actually would rather put up a hypocritical face, the face of a hypocrite, than to tell the black man, no, you stay over there and let me stay over here. So that's no solution. As long as you force people to act in a hypocritical way, you'll never solve that problem. It has to be, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that a solution has to be devised that'll be satisfactory, completely satisfactory to the black man, and completely satisfactory to the white man. And the only thing that makes white people completely satisfied and black people completely satisfied when they're in their right mind is when the black man has his own and the white man has his own. You have what you need, we have what we need. And then both of us have something, and even the Bible says, God bless the child that has his own. And the poor so-called Negro doesn't have his own name, doesn't have his own language, doesn't have his own culture, doesn't have his own history, he doesn't have his own country, he doesn't even have his own mind. And he thinks that he's black because God cursed him. He's not black because God cursed him. He's black because, rather, he's cursed because he's out of his mind. He has lost his mind. He has a white mind instead of the type of mind that he should have. So when these so-called Negroes who want integration try and force themselves into the white society, which doesn't solve the problem, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that that type of Negro is the one that creates the problem. And the type of white person who perpetuates the problem is the one who poses as a liberal pretends that the Negro should be integrated. And as long as he integrates someone else's neighborhood. But all these whites that you see running around here talking about how liberal they are, and we believe everybody should have what they want and go where they want and do what they want, as soon as a Negro moves into that white liberal's neighborhood, that white liberal is, he moves out faster than the white bigot from Mississippi, Alabama, and from someplace else. So we won't solve the problem listening to that Uncle Tom Negro, and the problem won't be solved listening to this so-called white liberal. The only time the problem is going to be solved is when a black man can sit down like a black man and a white man can sit down like a white man and make no excuses whatsoever with each other in discussing the problem. No offense will stem from factors that are brought up, but both of them have to sit down like men on one side and on the other side and look at it in terms of black and white, and then take some kind of solution based upon the factors that we see rather than upon that which we would like to believe. And when I said that this Negro wants to force his way into the white man's family, this integrationist-minded Negro wants to force his way into the white man's family, some don't believe that. Some take issue with that. But you take all of the integrationists, all of the those who are used to finance the program of the integrationists, the average so-called Negro celebrity, put all of them in one pot. And as fast as you name them off, you'll find that every one of them is married either to a white woman or a white man. From Lena Horne, Eartha Kitt, Sammy Davis, and you could name them all night long. They, although they say that this is not what we want, that's what they've done. That's what they have. And we don't, the black masses don't want what Lena Horne wants, or what Sammy Davis wants, or what, who's his name, the rest of them want. Usually you'll find that before Sammy Davis and Lena Horne and Eartha Kitt and Harry Belafonte become involved in a mixed marriage, you could go into the Negro community, anyone across the country, and find those stars with records on the jukeboxes in the Negro community. You can't walk into a Negro community today and find anybody that the Negro community knows is involved in a mixed marriage with their records being popular in the Negro community. Subconsciously, a Negro doesn't have any respect or regard or confidence, or nor can he be moved by another black, a black man who marries a white woman, or a black woman who marries a white man. And when they put out that picture to you that all of us want your woman, no, just that 20th century Uncle Tom. He wants her. And then when you think you're going to solve your problem by pleasing him, you're only making the problem worse. You have to go back and listen to the problem as it is presented by the masses of black people, not by these hand-picked handful of Uncle Toms who benefit from token integration. Also, this type of so-called Negro, by being intoxicated over the white man, he never sees beyond the white man. He never sees beyond America. He never looks at himself or where he fits into things on the world stage. He only can see himself here in America, on the American stage or the white stage, where the white man is in the majority, where the white man is the boss. So this type of Negro is always feels like he's outnumbered, or he's the underdog, or he's the minority. And it puts him in the role of a beggar, a cowardly, humble, Uncle Tommen beggar on anything that he says is that should be his by right. Whereas there is, when it comes, he wants to be an American rather than to be black. He wants to be something other than what he is. And knowing that America is a white country, he knows he can't be black and be an American too. So he never calls himself black. He calls himself an American Negro, a Negro in America. And usually he'll deny his own race, his own color, just to be a second-class American. He'll deny his own history, his own culture. He'll deny all of his brothers and sisters in Africa, in Asia, in the East, just to be a second-class American. He denies everything that he represents, or that everything that was in his past, just to be accepted into a country and into a government that has rejected him ever since he was brought here. Well, this Negro is sick. He has to be sick to try and force himself among some people who don't want him, or to be accepted into a government that has used its entire political system and educational system to keep him relegated to the role of a second-class citizen. And therefore, he spends a lifetime begging for acceptance into the same government that made slaves of his people. He gives his life for a country that made his people slaves and still confines them to the role of second-class citizens. And we feel that he wastes his time begging white politicians, political hypocrites, for civil rights or for some kind of first-class citizenship. He's like a watchdog or a hound dog. You may run into a dog. No matter how vicious a dog is, you find him out in the street, he won't bite you. But when you get him up on the porch, he will growl. He'll take your leg. Now, that dog, when he's out in the street, only his own life is threatened. And he's never been trained to protect himself. He's only been trained by his master to think in terms of what's good for his master. So when you catch him in the street and you threaten him, he'll go around you. But when you come up on the through the gate when he's sitting on the master's porch, then he'll bare his fangs and get ready to bite you. Not because you're threatening him, but because you're threatening his master, who has trained him not to protect himself, but to protect the property of the master. And this type of 20th century Uncle Tom is the same way. He'll never attack you, but he'll attack me. I can run into him out in the street and blast him. He won't say a word. But if I look like I'm about to blast you in here, he'll open up his mouth and put up a better defense for you than you can put up for yourself. Because he hasn't been trained to defend himself. He has only been trained to open up his mouth in defense of his master. He hasn't been educated. He's been trained. When a man is educated, he can think for himself and defend himself and speak for himself. But this 20th century Uncle Tom Negro never opens up his mouth in defense of a black man. He opens up his mouth in defense of the white man, in defense of America, in defense of the American government. He doesn't even know where his government is because he doesn't know that he ever had one. He doesn't know where his country is because he doesn't know that he ever had one. He believes in exactly what he was taught in school, that when he was kidnapped by the white man, he was a savage in the jungle someplace eating people and throwing spears and with a bone in his nose. And the average American Negro has that concept of the African continent. It is not his fault. This is what has been given to him by the American educational system. He doesn't realize that there were civilizations and cultures on the African continent at a time when the people in Europe were crawling around in the caves going naked. He doesn't realize that the black man in Africa was wearing silk, was wearing slippers that he was able to spin himself, make himself, at a time when the people up in Europe were going naked. He doesn't realize that he was living in palaces on the African continent when the people in Europe were living in caves. He doesn't realize that he was living in a civilization in Africa where science had been so far advanced, especially even the astronomical sciences, to a point where Africans could plot the course of the stars in the universe when the people up in Europe still thought the Earth was round, the planet was round, or flat. He doesn't realize the advancement and the high state of his own culture that he was living in before he was kidnapped and brought to this country by the white man. He knows nothing about that. He knows nothing about the ancient Egyptian civilization on the African continent, or the ancient Carthaginian civilization on the African continent, or the ancient civilizations of Mali on the African continent, civilizations that were highly developed and produced scientists. Timbuktu, the center of the Mali Empire, was the center of learning at a time when the people up in Europe didn't even know what a book was. He doesn't know this because he hasn't been taught. And because he doesn't know this, when you mention Africa to him, why, he thinks you're talking about a jungle. And I went to Africa in 1959 and didn't see any jungle and didn't see any mud huts until I got back to Harlem in New York City. So you're familiar with that type of Negro. And the black man that you're not familiar with is the one that we would like to point out now. He's the new type. He's the type that seldom the white man ever comes in contact with. And when you do come in contact with him, you're shocked because you didn't know that this type of black man existed. And immediately you think, well, here's one of those black supremacists or racists or extremists who believe in violence and all that little kind of, well, that's what they call it. This new type of black man, he doesn't want integration. He wants separation. Not segregation, separation. To him, segregation, as we're taught by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, means that which is forced upon inferiors by superiors. A segregated community is a Negro community. But the white community, though it's all white, is never called a segregated community. It's a separate community. In the white community, the white man controls the economy, his own economy, his own politics, his own everything. That's his community. But at the same time, all the Negro lives in a separate community. It's a segregated community, which means it's regulated from the outside by outsiders. The white man has all of the businesses in the Negro community. He runs the politics of the Negro community. He controls all the civic organizations in the Negro community. This is a segregated community. We don't go for segregation. We go for separation. Separation is when you have your own. You control your own economy. You control your own politics. You control your own society. You control your own everything. You have yours and you control yours. We have ours and we control ours. They don't call Chinatown in New York City or on the West Coast a segregated community. Yes, it's all Chinese. But the Chinese control it. Chinese voluntarily live there. They control it. They run it. They have their own schools. They control their own politics, control their own industry, and they don't feel like they're being made inferior because they have to live to themselves. They choose to live to themselves. They live there voluntarily, and they are doing for themselves in their community the same thing you do for yourself in your community. This makes them equal because they have what you have. But if they didn't have what you have, then they'd be controlled from your side, even though they would be on their side. They'd be controlled from your side by you. So when we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad say that we're for separation, it should be emphasized, we're not for segregation, we're for separation. We want the same for ourselves as you have for yourself. And when we get it, then it's possible to think more intelligently and to think in terms that are along peaceful lines. But a man who doesn't have what is his, he can never think always in terms that are along peaceful lines. This new type rejects the white man's Christian religion. He recognizes the real enemy. That Uncle Tom can't see his enemy. He thinks his friend is his enemy and his enemy is his friend. And he usually ends up loving his enemy, turning his other cheek to his enemy. But this new type, he doesn't turn the other cheek to anybody. He doesn't believe in any kind of peaceful suffering. He believes in obeying the law. He believes in respecting people. He believes in doing unto others as he would have done unto himself. But at the same time, if anybody attacks him, he believes in retaliating if it costs him his life. And it is good for white people to know this, because if white people get the impression that Negroes all endorse this old turn-the-other-cheek, cowardly philosophy of Dr. Martin Luther King, then whites are going to make the mistake of putting their hands on some black man thinking that he's going to turn the other cheek and he'll end up losing his hand and losing his life in the tribe. So it is always better to let someone know where you stand. And there are a large number of black people in this country who don't endorse any phase of what Dr. Martin Luther King and these other 20th century religious Uncle Toms are putting in front of the public eye to make it look like this is the way, this is the behavior, or this is the thought pattern of most of our people. Also, this new type, you'll find, he doesn't look upon it as being any honor to be in America. He knows he didn't come here on the Mayflower. He knows he was brought here in a slave ship. But this 20th century Uncle Tom, he'll stand up in your face and tell you about when his fathers landed on Plymouth Rock. His father never landed on Plymouth Rock. The rock was dropped on him, but it wasn't dropped on me. So this type doesn't make any apology for being in America, nor does he make any apology for the problem his presence in America presents for Uncle Sam. He knows he was brought here in chains, and he knows he was brought here against his will. He knows that the problem itself was created by the white man, and that it was created because the white man brought us here in chains against our will. It was a crime. And the one who committed that crime is the criminal today who should pay for the crime that was committed. You don't put the crime in jail. You put the criminal in jail. And kidnapping is a crime. Slavery is a crime. Lynching is a crime. And the presence of 20 million black people in America against their will is a living witness or living testimony of the crime that Uncle Sam committed, your forefathers committed, when our people were brought here in chains. And the reason the problem can't be solved today is you try and dress it up and doctor it up and make it look like a favor was done to the black man by having brought the black man here. But when you realize that it was a crime that was committed, then you approach the solution to that problem in a different light, and then you can probably solve it. And as long as you think Negroes are running around here of the opinion that you're doing them a favor by letting them have some of this and letting them have some of that, why, naturally, every time you give a little bit more justice or freedom to the black man, you stick out your chest and say, see, we're solving the problem. You're not doing the black man any favor. If you stick a knife in my back, if you pull it in 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, you haven't done me any favor. If you pull it all the way out, you haven't done me any favor. And this is what you have to realize. If you put a man in jail against his will, illegally, he's not guilty, you frame him up, and then because he resents what you've done to him, you put him in solitary confinement to break his spirit. After his spirit is broken, you let him out a little bit and give him the general run of the prison. You haven't done him any favor. If you let him out of prison completely, you haven't done him any favor because you put him in there unjustly and illegally in the first place. Now you have 20 million black people in this country who were brought here and put in a political, economic, and mental prison. This was done by Uncle Sam. And today you don't realize what a crime your forefathers have committed. And you think that when you open the door a few cracks and give this little integration an intoxicated Negro a chance to run around in the prison yard, that's all he's doing, that you're doing him a favor. But as long as he has to look up to someone who doesn't represent him and who doesn't speak for him, that person only represents the warden. It doesn't represent some kind of president or mayor or governor or senator or congressman or anything else. So this new type, the fact has to be faced that he exists, especially since he's in the House. And he didn't come here against his will, so you have to take the blame for his being here. And once you take the blame, then it's more easy. It's easier for you to approach the problem more sensibly and try and get a solution. And the solution can never be based upon hypocrisy. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad says that this solution has to be based upon reality. Tokenism is hypocrisy. One little student in the University of Mississippi, that's hypocrisy. A handful of students in Little Rock, Arkansas is hypocrisy. A couple students going to school in Georgia is hypocrisy. Integration in America is hypocrisy in the rawest form, and the whole world can see it. All this little tokenism that is dangled in front of the Negro, and then he's told, see what we're doing for you, Tom. Why, the whole world can see that this is nothing but hypocrisy, and all you do is make your image worse. You don't make it better. So again, this new type, as I say, he rejects the white man's Christian religion. You find in large numbers they're turning toward the religion of Islam. They're becoming Muslims, believing in one God whose proper name is Allah, and Muhammad as his apostle, and turning towards Mecca, praying 5 times a day, fasting during Ramadan, and all of the other principles that are laid out by the religion of Islam. He's becoming a Muslim, and just as I think it was Dr. Billy Graham who made a crusade through Africa and came back and said that Islam is sweeping through Africa, outnumbering Christianity in converts 11 to 1, which means every time one African becomes a Christian, 11 of them become a Muslim. And then that one who became a Christian, he forgets it and going on to be a Muslim too. And Bishop Pike pointed out the same thing in Look magazine in December 1960, and then Time magazine, heaven forbid that I should mention that magazine, but Time magazine... Time magazine mentioned in 2 weeks ago that Islam is sweeping throughout Africa. And just as it is sweeping throughout the black people of Africa, it's sweeping throughout the black people right here in America. Only the one who's teaching it here in America is the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He is the religious leader, the religious teacher. He is the one that is spreading the religion of Islam among the slaves, ex-slaves, here in America. You have Muslims who have come to this country from the Muslim world. There are probably 200,000 Muslims in this country from the Muslim world who were born in the Muslim world. And all of them combined have never been able to convert 100 Americans to the religion of Islam. Yet it's the nature of Islam to propagate the faith, to spread the faith, to make everyone bear witness that there's no God but Allah and Muhammad is his apostle. And if you find all of the Muslims of the Muslim world who come here unable or incapable of turning the American people toward Allah and toward Mecca and toward Islam, and then this little black man from the cotton fields of Georgia is able to stand up and get black people by the hundreds of thousands to turn toward Mecca five times a day and give praise to Allah and come together in unity and harmony, well, you'd have to be out of your mind to think the people of the Muslim world don't recognize the wonderful religious and spiritual accomplishment that's being achieved here among the so-called Negroes by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And I take time to mention that because the propagandists try and convey the picture that we're not Muslims, we're not religiously motivated, and that we are in no way identified or recognized or connected with our people of the Muslim world. Well, if they didn't recognize us, we wouldn't care. We're not particularly looking for recognition. We're looking for recognition from Allah, from God. And if Allah accepts you as a Muslim, you're accepted. It's not left up to somebody walking around here on this earth. But those people over there would be out of their mind when they find themselves unable to spread the religion of Islam, and then they see this little black man here in America spreading it, why, they'd be out of their mind to reject him. And you'll find, if you take the time to look, that you don't find any Muslim today who rejects another Muslim. You might find some that who come over here who operate stores or some kind of little business in the white neighborhood, Christian neighborhood, and they want to get along with all the white people, but all the Christians, they might say some words to please you, but they're only trying to get your money. So the followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad look to him and what he teaches, his program and his message, as our only solution. And they see separation as our only salvation. We don't think as Americans anymore, but as a black man. With the mind of a black man, we look beyond America, and we look beyond the interests of the white man. The thinking of this new type of Negro is broad. It's more international. This integrationist always thinks in terms of an American. But you find the masses of black people today think in terms of black. And this black thinking enables them to see beyond the confines of America, and they look all over the world. They look at the happenings in the international context by this little integrationist Negro thinking locally, by his thinking and desires being confined to America. He's limited. He's the underdog. He's the minority. But the masses of black people who have been exposed to the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, their thinking is more international. They look on this earth and they see that the majority of the people on this earth are dark. And by seeing that the majority of the people on this earth are dark, they don't regard themselves as a minority in America, but rather they regard themselves as part of that vast, dark majority. So therefore, when you run into that type of black man, he doesn't speak as an underdog. He doesn't speak like you outnumber him, or he doesn't speak like there's any harm that you can do to him. He speaks as one who outnumbers you. He sees that the dark world outnumbers the white world, that the odds have turned today and are in his favor, that are on his side. He sees that the people of this earth are on his side, that time is on his side, that history is on his side, and most important of all, he sees that God is on his side toward getting him some kind of solution that's immediate and that's lasting and that is in no way connected or concerned or stems from the goodwill or good conscience in any way, shape, soever of the man who committed the crime and created the problem in the first place. I would like to point out quickly and briefly. No, I want to. I think my time is up, isn't it?
Yeah, just about.
Well, doctor here says my time is up. And I'm telling him his time is short, so. So I think what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
As a white liberal.